Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast, where we talk to foresters about how they are using digital technologies in their day-to-day forestry work. Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast. Today, I am joined by Eli Jensen. He's the owner of Ironwood Forestry. Eli, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Yeah, for sure. Really excited to have this conversation. And before we got started, we were talking about temperatures where I am and temperatures where you are. I think I'm hotter than where you are at. But where are we reaching you today?
Absolutely. Today, I'm calling in from Flagstaff, Arizona. That's where my business is based off of. And today, I think it's cloudy today. It's probably, I didn't look, maybe 80 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, that's a nice comfortable temperature. And you said monsoon season is coming. So I guess the rain is coming maybe to the part of the world I just stereotype as dry. But with monsoon, there must be rain. So I know I looked at your website and there's a couple things and your LinkedIn profile. And there's a couple things that kind of made me giggle. And the first one was you describe yourself as an army brat. So I'm just curious to know how many countries have you lived in, or maybe how many countries did mom and dad drag you around? But maybe tell us how you started off and how you got into this world of forestry.
Yeah, I am an army brat. So I was born in the United States, so born in Albuquerque. Berlin, Wisconsin, Michigan, back to Germany, Augsburg, Hanau, Alabama, South Korea, Florida, Tennessee, Germany again, and then Flagstaff, Arizona.
Holy camoly. So that must mean you're fluent in German and Vietnamese and Thai and every fluent in 12 languages must be by now, right?
Just ein Bier bitte. Right?
There you go. So yeah, and we're all familiar with our Heffenweisen and all of that. So yeah, so thinking of that, maybe how did you get into forestry? Like, was there a weird someone in the family that was in this practice, or maybe a love of the outdoors, or just that whirlwind travel of like, gee whiz, all these different places and what sounds like a pretty short time frame?
I think it was the travel. You know, I think it's very common that, you know, people's family members were in forestry, and that was not the case for me. I've been kind of all over the world except for out west. And Northern Arizona University kept sending me these postcards of the mountains, of the San Francisco peaks, and say, hey, come to forestry school in Arizona. And I didn't really have a different plan. So it's kind of maybe even an act of rebellion, you know, get away a little bit further away from home. And so I went out west and I started going to school in Arizona for forestry. And I tried to leave many times, trying to take other jobs, but it just kept pulling me back.
No kidding. And you didn't just do an undergrad degree. You stayed on for a master's degree as well. So obviously that calling was quite strong or kept you in that area. But maybe tell us about what got you to do a master's, and maybe what your thesis or research was about.
Yeah, I have to be really honest with you, Kevin. I was a really poor student in my undergrad. I had a lot of extracurriculars. I took a lot of art classes, took a lot of PE classes, ceramics, metal smithing, and I started my first business, Eli Jensen Knives. So I was making knives and forging knives before it was really popular, you know, with the show on the History Channel coming out and everything like that. And so I did that for 2 years after my undergraduate. I had my own business for 2 years, and I didn't make very much money. So I got a lot of accomplishments. I was published a number of times in various magazines, but I looked at the books and I made $37 in 2 years. So I asked my
wife, profitable at least, right? Yeah. You're profitable, come on.
Yeah, I was profitable. So I asked my wife to loan me $5 so I could take her out to dinner with my earnings. And then I restarted my forestry career after that. And I wanted to go back to grad school as like a second chance, to have the guidance and facilitation to really give it another go. And I, I didn't do anything with geomatics or LIDAR or anything. I did wood science. I did a pilot project on thermal modification of ponderosa pine. So you cook it, you know, wood is made out of sugars. So you caramelize it and it's value added. And it was a great project. And but the underlying goal, the intent was to increase the value of low value ponderosa pine as a solution for forest restoration. So that was kind of my first, involvement with the local forest restoration, with the Four Forest Restoration Initiative. So then I did some seasonal jobs here and there. I got into contracting. There wasn't a lot of jobs back then. That was 2016. It was, you know, if your buddy heard of a job, he wasn't going to tell you about it, right? So I thought that I was on more of an academic path. I saw myself maybe doing a PhD, but it wasn't in the stars. I went out, it was every Western forester's nightmare. I went to Arkansas in the winter and I learned all my hardwoods without leaves. Right. I did. I sat in the library for, 3 days and I learned them. The funny part of that is then in the spring when everything leafed out, I didn't know what anything was anymore because the buds were gone. So I got into the, production field forestry kind of line of work, and I started my own business to do contracts close to home. And I did 3 summers of stand exams, just out there by myself, just crushing them every day until my eyes were crossed. You know, I saw diameters and heights and everywhere I went, you know. And then I had the idea for a new paint sprayer. I was doing some side work for another contractor painting trees, and I was using the old sprayer and I hated it. And it took about 2 days. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to build my own paint sprayer. And I did. And I needed to prove it because, Forest Service, they're a little bit shy. Like, go prove it. So I built the company, I hired the crew, I got on the contracts, and I grew to be the number one timber sale prep provider for the state of Arizona. Right, we were
Nice.
doing 9,000 acres a year, and yeah, it proved the sprayer, right? It works great, but it wasn't enough. So I started introducing new things, and the first thing that I did, interestingly enough, this was born out of my own ignorance of contracting. I didn't know how they were going to inspect my mark that I laid out, and I was really nervous because what I didn't know is that if you fail inspection, it costs you a lot of money. So I had an app whipped up for the platform I was using, where we'll drop a pin on every tree that we paint, and we'll put the diameter on that pin, and we'll do it really quick. And the time it takes to drop the pin, you make up for. You've got early career technicians. They're building a map, so you're saving on situational awareness. They're not looking around so much. Where am I? So we did that, and next thing you know, I've got 100,000 pins on my computer of every tree that will be in the sale after it's been, thinned out. So I'm like, hey, that's really cool. This is like census level data. You don't see a lot of census level data in forestry, especially this is back in 2020. So of course, I'm still not getting traction with my business, so it's got to be better. Like it keeps escalating. Right. And someone asked, well, how is this better than aerial LIDAR or LIDAR in general? And my answer was not either or. What if it was both? So I snapped that data set to the LIDAR, to the aerial LIDAR, and I got these orange and blue blobs, your canopy cover. It was just the outline. It wasn't even a canopy height model. And I'm like, these orange blobs, that's the future forest. And everyone's like, but because it's a little esoteric, so I knew it had to be even better. Like it has to be like the art of forestry. It has to tap into that emotional part that we all love about forestry. So it took me a while, but I begged and borrowed, and I got a scanner, and I went out and I did 5 acres of a sale that I'd already marked, and then I tagged the trees that I had painted, and I said, okay. This is what the forest is going to look like when they thin it. And man, that was the magic sauce right there. That was the password. That's what did it. So that turned into a full-size project, which I'm executing right now. It's just over 3,000 acres, and I've got to scan every single tree with a backpack scanner in that sale. And when it's done, I'll have all the data. You know, we have the science, but the art too. I'll be like, we're going to colorize that point cloud really well, just on the computer on this first one. But it's going to look, you know, it's going to look real enough. And it's like, this is what the whole sale is going to look like. And if you don't like it, well, guess what? The trees aren't cut yet. You know, it's a whole lot easier to go make edits than to shed tears about cutting the wrong trees.
Very interesting. I feel like if you're carrying around a backpack LiDAR, that man, I'm looking at my Apple Watch or whatever rock watch you're rocking, your step count must be like through the roof if you're doing that type of work on 3,000 acres. But fascinating. I'm gonna kind of like bounce around a little bit in that story because it's really cool. And I'm curious on a couple fronts. So one thing I have to admit, when I was on your website, I actually kind of burst out laughing because there's a timeline that describes the horizon or key milestones of Ironwood Forestry. And I think the first one was initial point of frustration, and it had to do with your spray painting device. Tell me more about that. I know you kind of just say, oh yeah, I did this and I kind of made that. And meanwhile, when I look at the information, my research, there was Mark version one. And I think what I saw was now we're at Mark version seven. So somewhere between one and seven, I'm assuming there was a lot of experimentation, trials and tribulations, et cetera. But maybe walk us through, what this Mark One did, and then maybe the Mark Seven, like what are those really key differences now? And I'm assuming these things are for sale. Why someone would buy a Mark Seven if they're a tree marker?
Yeah, they're not for sale yet, but we're working on that. We could talk more about that in a bit. But I've actually gone back now to just calling it the Mark One because my joke is that's also the instruction manual. You just mark one and then mark another and you just keep going. But I kind of lost count of all the different versions. It probably would be closer to 30 or 40. But the first version, right? It's a pressure tank, right? It's full of pressurized air and paint. So any mistakes can result in like paint flying everywhere, right? And I got lucky the first time, or unlucky, I don't know, but there's a pressure in a quick connect, right, in the male end. And the first configuration is just pointing straight up. Okay, fill it up. Let's go 150 PSI, which is okay. Now we know that's too much. Right. Okay. Well, how do you depressurize this tank? Right. Well, you take that quick connect off, but of course you need to be leaning over it. Right. And boom. And it just came out so fast and it blew me away. Literally. Okay. Now you add a valve, right. And you can let it out slow. And so we kept tinkering and adding things. And so now there's filters, which is good because sometimes little bits of pine needles get in the paint. So there's filters, and now we have a two-stage filter, you know, 50 mesh, 100 mesh. The first big upgrade we did is, so anybody that's ever tried to make this sprayer, right? I'm not the first one that's trying to redo it. And the reason I know I'm the only one that's successful is because everybody else, their first thought is CO2, right? Why not? So we started with CO2, and it was hilarious. Kevin, it carbonates the paint. Because you put the CO2 in the paint and then you're walking around and shaking it. And so, you know, it's a 3 gallon tank. So you put in like a gallon and a half and then you spray for an hour and then there's like, it's bubbling out because it's just.
You made a soda stream paint marker. Okay, yeah.
And you paint on the trees and it's bubbling on the trees and. But it comes out really foamy, so you know we switched to atmospheric air. It works a lot better, and it's a lot safer. CO2 tanks can be dangerous to refill if you don't know what you're doing. So there's been all these little upgrades along the way, but the atmospheric air and then the adjustable spray nozzles are kind of the big ones because the adjustable spray nozzle, you're going to save a lot of money in paint, you know, and that's where the frustrations came from. You know, I don't want to bite the hand that feeds me, but the federal government is very slow to adopting new ideas. And I came to them and I'm like, hey, I'm, because they're buying the paint, they're giving us the paint. Well, we're the taxpayers are buying the paint. And I'm like, I'm saving you more money in paint than you're paying me to paint it. And if you count that in my bid, my competitors will have to pay you to outcompete me. And they didn't know what to do. Right. And so we had to go through some growing pains, and it never really got to that competitive advantage that I wanted, you know, and we were leaning more towards the digital stuff anyways. So those were the initial frustrations. And now we're just adding cool stuff like the emergency relief valve. You put a balloon over it. So if it overpressurizes, the balloon will inflate, and maybe it'll pop and scare you and you'll stop what you're doing. But the real reason is just to keep the springs clean.
Right. Very cool though. Very cool. Like just to go through that process and experimentation, like sounds like lots of like trials and experiments and laughter as well in hindsight, maybe during the time. But that's part of the entrepreneur journey. You gotta kind of at it and see what comes out of it. So very cool, very cool. Definitely like that. And so one thing I know, one of the reasons when I reached out was because recently you wrote an article in the Society of American Foresters about forest architecture. And I think what you described about your journey, about like that census level of that tree, doing different work, and then how you were doing that data collection and then scaling it up to 3,000 acres. Is there a focus mostly on public land management, like thinking of the commercial forestry side of things, et cetera? Are you really targeting them, or is this really more around that public land and making sure that from a stakeholder engagement point of view, that people can be included in that participatory process in terms of what's happening on the land? But maybe what's the Ironwood focus, I guess, big picture with is it public lands, or is there something a bit more than that?
It's definitely public lands, and you know that's a function of that's my background. I you know came from working on the public lands as you know Forest Service seasonal, going to school in Arizona, which is dominated by public land management. But I also think that the value proposition hits home a little bit harder when you have that strong multiple use directive. If you're looking at it just from a cruising data standpoint, right? You're getting into diminishing returns because you already get like I don't know if I would call it census level, like from aerial or drone or airplane LiDAR, you know. But it's getting better and better, you know. You know, 80% detection, 85, 90. You know, we're getting up there. Like, how much better is your cruise data really going to be, right? Maybe there's some cases, you know, very high value species that are, you know, not homogenous across the landscape. I don't know. But, you know, public land, there's so much to consider. You know, you do want good data, but, you know, what is it going to look like? You know, I know our private industry, they do think about those things. I don't want to paint, you know, them with the wrong picture, but in public land management, like it is just, it's paramount, right? The project I'm preparing surrounds the community of Kachina Village, right? People are looking not at the paint, or not only the paint, but they're going to be looking at the result, you know, for the rest of their lives. It's their backyard, it's their view. And there's no such thing in public forestry as the back 40 anymore, right? Every acre is recreated somehow. If you think you're in the middle of nowhere, well, that's where people are hunting in the fall. You know, that's where you know somebody goes with their dad or their grandpa, you know, to go hunt, you know, or to watch birds, you know. So every part of the forest is highly visible. So there's that engage. There's the engagement from the recreators, but there's also, you know, those whose role it is to keep the Forest Service accountable. You know, the environmental groups. You know, we paint them in a bad light, and you know, for better or worse, but they serve a purpose, right? And this is a tool for them. If we're following our forest plan and we met the intent and the metrics of the prescription, right? But we're bulletproof, right? We don't have to worry about being litigated.
Right.
But even to prevent it from getting that far, you know, you can talk with them like, hey, what do you want it to look like? Do you want it to look like this? Do you want to look it to look like that? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So thinking of that, has there been any, like, you're using a backpack LiDAR, is there, what can you share on the technology that you're using? Is this really commercial off the shelf technology, or is this the Mark One or the Mark Seven modified for mobile LiDAR? What can you tell us about the technology you're using, and maybe some of the challenges you've encountered starting off, and maybe where you are now? Because I suspect there's probably some speed bumps. We all think everything's easy, and then something as simple as, you know, whether it's coordinates or something, or projections trips us up or something like that. But what can you share us about the technology, given our audience, our listeners? Some are very technical on the LiDAR, airborne, terrestrial, like mobile and stuff. But what can you share on that front?
Yeah, everything I'm using is off the shelf commercial equipment. I'd love to tinker with that. You can probably tell I like to tinker. You know, you can do anything you want, but not everything. So it's all commercial equipment, and yeah, everything's easy when you know how to do it. But we did hit a lot of speed bumps, and some of them we expected, some of them we did not. And the first one that came up that we didn't expect is the SLAM algorithms. Most of them are not designed for large scale forestry landscapes.
So what does that mean for our listeners who don't know SLAM?
Simultaneous location and mapping. So it's the code. It takes, you know, all the points in the point cloud, and the SLAM is what kind of like stitches it together into something intelligible, corrects for any drifts, identifies features, and kind of makes sure everything is whole. And so our issue is that things were not whole. You know, we would do, what we learned is this, you know, a standard lawnmower pattern worked best. You know, we tried everything, spirals, zigzags, stars, whatever, just a simple lawnmower works best. So if you go, if you start here and you scan a feature here and you go and that feature leaves the scanner's, I call it zone of awareness, you know, it's outside of the range, and then it comes back. You know, we were getting a lot of trunks that looked like this.
So offset, they don't look like real trunks. Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. They weren't matching up. And so I went to a lot of trade shows, and I'm like, I just, you know, asking people for help basically. And, you know, there was one brand, I don't know if you stay brand agnostic on your show.
Oh no, we can talk about it. It's whatever you want to share. Yeah.
Yeah, we started with a GeoSLAM. So I don't know what Farrell's got under the hood, but it's stitching things together just fine. And so we're still using a GeoSLAM rental. And so I went out, and every other brand that I tried had this same problem. And we bought a scanner, and we had this problem, and they weren't able to fix it. And so that was kind of like, that was painful. You know, they didn't want to lose that on a sale. And I didn't want to be in the hole for all that money for a paperweight, you know? So that was very, very painful and long and drawn out. And so I still wanted to buy one because I didn't want to rely on this rental. And so I went out and like, okay, try before you buy. We went, we did a demo. This is now XN. We're talking about XN scanners. And we went to Denver and we scanned, and like, same problem. You know, my heart is broken. And now I've got to drive to, we were doing a demo for Colorado State Forestry. I'm driving the meeting, like, and they called me, they're like, on the drive to the meeting, they fixed it. You know, so I'm like, all right. You know, so that gave me information about who else is trying this out there. Because nobody who's using commercial equipment has tried this, or this would have been solved. And what they said is like, it was an easy fix. They just never had this use case before. Yeah. So that was a big one. I now own an XN scanner. I love working with XN. They're good guys. Looking forward to working with other brands as well in the future.
Yeah, very cool. Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because I know in my earlier days, when we were, before we got onto the pod, I was kind of kind of calling myself the prehistoric fossil. I remember some groups trying that with the mobile, and within, 5 feet, 6 feet, the thing was lost because there weren't those really hard targets, for the slam algorithm to tie everything together. So it's great to hear. Congrats on solving that, or maybe picking a manufacturer's butt to solve that. But critical, I guess, especially if you're doing that type of 3,000 acre scale there. Like, if you can't get the algorithm to pull it all together, and you got trees that don't look like trees, you might have a different problem with stakeholder engagement or review or visualization, or maybe distrust, right? And like, what's
The
so great
data.
about this technology? Okay.
It was weird because the crayons came out perfect. So if we want to do a visuals, like, it'd be fine. I don't know why. It was just the trunks. Well, the silvicultures, like, that's what he wants. So
So it sounds like you got your device chosen now. It's working, it walks, you're collecting good point data. Any pushback from your community around, precision of measurements and whatnot? Or was it mostly focused on, the visualization on if I have thinned this, or if I remove these trees? Was precision ever an issue or a key thing in your work?
yeah, it's come up quite a bit, more with the managers, people that are interested in the visuals. It's less important to them, or they have a higher tolerance. But when we put the contract out, or when so this is it's a good neighbor agreement with the Forest Service and Arizona Department of Forestry and Fire. So when the state put out the solicitation, they didn't know what to put for the inspection criteria, the acceptability standards, because they're like, well, we're kind of making this up. So, there's plenty of other people who have worked on, what's the level of precision in these machines, at whatever range and point density, and kind of we looked at that, so what we settled on is 90% of the trees have to be plus or minus 2 inches. And for what we're doing, we're hitting that pretty spot on. It's not too much more precise. We've got especially like forked trees or trees with really low dense crowns. We're getting some errors as you would expect. But if it's a clean stem, we're getting the precision that we need. And of course, it's over it's census level. So it's way more powerful data than, hyper focused measurements on 0.1% of your trees, right?
Yeah,
So
absolutely. Absolutely.
still very, very valuable. And then what I told them is, if we don't meet these standards, I mean, there's nothing that I can do because it's going to take the scan that it's going to take. And we talked about trying out different software suites, and that's kind of really all you can do is, if you take a good scan. So right now they're being inspected on a visual basis. The state, John Pelak is working for the state. He did his master's on LIDAR, so they're lucky to have him. He's looked at a lot of mobile LIDAR, the same model, the GeoSLAM. So it's kind of like it's either a good scan or it's not. There's not a lot of in between. I mean, there's some nuances about like distance and range. The trees that are in the middle of our scan patterns, we expect those to be a little bit fuzzier. But we're doing a really tight 35 yard distance. So we tried even up to 100 yards. Like, yeah, you get points, but we decided to keep it pretty tight just because, well, we like walking in the woods. So.
Absolutely. So you're walking in the woods in like 3,000 acres. So like, what's the forecasted time for completion, or maybe what's the average miles walked by a forester, or what can you give us? What can you share with us to give us a sense of the magnitude of this effort? Because it's not like a 1 day job here. Like, this is a lengthy process.
So it really is, it's very dynamic. Our best day, probably we did 150 acres in a day. We had two people out there, one with the Rendel, one with the XN scanner. So somebody that knows what they're doing and they're well motivated, they can do 100 acres a day. That's not crazy. The hiccups that we've been coming into is like, okay, right now our XN is out for repairs because one of the blades on one of the fans chipped off. You know, not a big deal. It's just downtime. Right now we're dealing with scanners overheating. So it'll be 90 degrees and full sun. And that scanner's running, like, it's supposed to be running 10 hours a day. And I don't think it was designed to run that much. So now I own a fleet of battery powered fans that are pointing, you know, two at the data logger, one at the, you know, sensor head. And I got these cool cooling units, you know, magnetic cooling units. So that's been slowing us down. But we hope to be done scanning by the end of the month, you know, so it's really ramped up, you know. But I think after this project, like what I really like about this project, and it's important to understand, is like it's not an academic project. You know, it can't be done whenever it's going to be done. Like there's a deadline.
Yeah.
And if it's not done by that deadline, I don't get paid. So that's really cool. It's also really scary. So we've got to settle on a minimum viable product, you know, because we could have spent years looking at what's the most efficient way to scan a 3,000 acre project. You know, we could look into drones and swarm drones and Boston robotic dogs and, you know, all these things. But sometimes, like, all right, we have a minimum viable product. We know there's ways we can speed this up, but we just got to get it done.
Yeah, for sure. Sometimes good is good enough. And well, you definitely don't want to hire me than help you out, because you mentioned 90 with the fans. This guy would turn the fans on myself, not on the device, and probably just walk around and go, this isn't so bad. It's kind of cool. Nice breeze. And then totally get a quarter of the work done. So yeah, you don't want to hire this guy. And so we collect this data, and then I know from looking and doing the research, and there's that visualization component. And I think your idea is here, we have like this full sense of all the trees, and to paraphrase, we can do whatever we want with the scene. We can remove these trees to see what it looks like. We can maybe do some advanced modeling, but maybe pull us into that forest architecture concept that you introduced into the SAF, Society of American Foresters journal. You're making the case that maybe that forest technician is a term that doesn't adequately describe that role, maybe, and that work might be going deeper given some of these capabilities. But maybe introduce us to this your thesis around a forest architect and what you see the future looking like as a forest architect person.
Yeah, that term, I'll come clean. I appropriated that term from the architecture community. They use it to describe building, you know, high-end buildings around nature. I'm like, I don't really want to copy them, appropriate them, but it just fits too well. You know, we're going to have to coexist with that term. Because when you think about architecture, like, you don't design a building with, like, average square footage in your room sizes, right? You'll lose your job. You know, it's very, very precise, like to the foot or to the inch or to the sub inch. Everything is just planned out. Nothing is left to chance. You know, I'm not versed enough in that industry to know how that comes across through the actual construction, you know, if they get what they want. But when it's designed, like, it's designed very, very deliberately. And so now we have that ability with our forest. You know, it's not quite to like every seedling, every sapling, but, you know, every tree to the foot, this is what you want. You know, your basal area per acre, your trees per acre, your canopy cover per acre. It's just with precision. You plan it on the computer until you get it exactly the way you want it, and then you execute it. You know, like, there's no more guesswork. And one of the early you know, sentiments of resistance that I had is that, you know, okay, everything's gonna then be in rows and be homogeneous. It's like, no, you can plan your heterogeneity. And, you know, what came to light is maybe some managers were using uncertainty as a proxy for heterogeneity. And, well, I don't know what else you can do, you know, with the tools we used to have. But now we have the tools, we can plan it really with precision. And I first started thinking about that term, you know, even before I started the LIDAR, Like, how do you get people, how do you get young people to be forestry technicians and timber sale prep? You know, because when you have wildland firefighters, you know, and they earn all the glory that they get, right? But they're wildland firefighters, they're heroes. You know, we don't call them line diggers. That would be kind of almost a little derogatory, you know? So why do we call them tree markers? You know, like, the marking is the tool. What they really are doing is designing the forest. They're forest architects in a way. And back then it's like, well, they're an architect in their own forest, in their own head, and then there's no way to share it. And so, you know, the idea to brand it that way kind of was on the back burner for a while. And then, you know, it came back up, and I put it to the profession in this article and presentations I've given, like, this is forest architecture, and there's been almost no resistance.
Interesting. Interesting. I have to admit, when I read the article, because it was reasonably recently published there, I have to say my initial gut response was, oh, another term, like, will it fit? I don't know. And I kind of thought about it. But then, to your point, there is something called landscape architecture, and no one kind of balks and goes like, well, it's landscape architect. It's like, well, they do landscape architecture, to your point. There's a reason there's a rock there. There's a reason there's this type of stone of this size put there for drainage or something. So that maybe got me thinking more in terms of, well, maybe there's something here around, you know, forest architecture, and maybe there's something more. And I'd think it would be a fascinating panel discussion. Maybe I think you're presenting at the SAF 2024 in Colorado this year, and it'd be great to hear the feedback the community gives you from on that topic. But time will tell. I'm curious to see how that goes. So I'm curious to maybe do a 5-minute rapid fire. I know the audience, the digital forester audience, I know there's always going to be naysayers, right, in terms of why you can't do this, versus it sounds like you're more of a guy where it's like, how can I get this done, and how can I move things forward, and I'm not going to get hung up on all the speed bumps, the naysayers and all that stuff. I'm just going to do it and then learn from that process.
I love naysayers.
Yeah. So I'm going to role play. I'm going to be Mr. Kevin Naysayer. 3,000 acres, that's kind of small. It's like, how do you scale this out to be something like practical, pragmatic, that could be acquired consistently? Or maybe if we had to acquire those 3,000s again, like, at what cadence will we do it? So maybe those people that are always maybe the Debbie Downers on why it doesn't work, and, you know, you can't walk. Meanwhile, I always say just hire a bunch of students and there you go, problem solved, mass labor applied, and you're done in half the time. But for those people who say, like, this is just not scalable, Eli, what's your response back to them?
Two parts. First part is, you would not be looking at a second acquisition, right? You have the data, it's dynamic, and if you want to update it, there's other ways that you can do that. Already we've compared our LiDAR to the airplane LiDAR from a couple of years ago. And like, hey, where's that tree? Oh, there it is on the ground. You know, so you can use lower cost, lower resolution acquisitions to update your data set, you know, because you don't need the measurements again. You just need, like, is the tree there or is that tree not there? Where I am, probably the slowest growing forest in the world. So not worried about the trees growing. I've probably got 20 years before that's a concern. The second thing, and the second answer, I guess, is a two-part answer. One is Northern Arizona, no bugs, no brush. You know, it's not super hot. Oh, dang, I got to go hike in the woods all day, right?
Oh, dang.
Oh, man. But that's going to be replaced. I mean, maybe not the next project, but maybe the one after that. I mean, probably a single drone could replace a technician on foot. There's a reason we didn't use drones on this first one. You know, one is simplicity. Two is endangered species, Mexican spotted owl habitat nearby. So there were some questions about that. And then I'm pretty close to town, so I've got airport flight restrictions that are a pain. But in the future, I mean, I see, honestly, swarm drones. You know, if you have a team of minimum two, you know, one below canopy, one above canopy, that would replace a technician pretty quick. And then if you add more drones to that swarm, you could collect a lot a very high resolution LiDAR very, very quickly.
Right. And so when you talk about capturing the data once, getting a sense of some, maybe fusing it with other types of data, because now you have, presence, absence of that tree. I'm Kevin, Mr. Naysayer again. Yeah, but what about the canopy architecture, Eli? If we think about other alternative uses of habitat and wildlife structure, how do we capture that if we're not revisiting it at a high cadence? Are we going to grow them, with some simulator, or how do we handle that temporal aspect for that stakeholder engagement for multiple recreational uses, as an example?
I think it depends on your goals. If you have very, very high valuable timber, you may be able to justify the expense of another high resolution acquisition, right? But otherwise, what is the period of change in that metric that you're looking for? If your canopy changes over 5 years and it's important, maybe you're gonna look to reacquire every 5 years. Looking to the future, like, the only thing that is for certain is that in 5 years, this will look a lot different. There'll be a lot other options out there. So it really depends on your goal. As far as kind of you touched on a very important subject, which is growth modeling. I mean, what individual tree data can do for modeling? Man, if anybody in your audience is an upcoming master's or PhD student, man, I have got some data for you, right? Because
Be careful what you wish for, my friend.
the state of Arizona has got some data for you. It's open source data. I mean, you ask the state, they have to give it to you. It's public data. But growth modeling, I mean, fire behavior modeling, insect behavior modeling, like every kind of modeling out there can be upgraded with this kind of, you can model on a tree by tree basis, and that has a lot of utility in the future because let's say, you present three options for treatment, let's say no treatment, treatment A, treatment B, and treatment C, different spatial arrangements. And then you put a growth modeling, a growth model, a fire simulator, all these different simulators on a future stand that doesn't exist yet, and see if you get the desired behavior. You're limited to how good your model is, but it gets better and better. So I'm
Right.
excited to see what other people can do. I'm not a modeler. I wish I was, but I'd really like to see what can be done with this level of data.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I know in a couple previous pods we had some folks from Visual Forester on talking about some of their visualization technology. And then when I was looking at what you're doing, honestly, I was like, oh, in the network of Digital Forester podcasts, there's a couple folks that if you all connected, I'm like, you guys can do some really, really kick ass and cool things. So enough of being Kevin being Mr. Naysayer, Debbie Downer here. I think I commend you for doing that work. 3,000 acres. I can't wait to see when you're done and the full blown like digital twin. I think it'll be amazing and a powerful just to walk through it, especially as someone who doesn't know that type of forest very well, just being able to visualize and go like, wow, that's really cool. But maybe on a more lighthearted question there before we shift gears more on the technology lens. You have to have scanned something totally far out, whether some, I don't know what kind of wildlife running across the scene or across your path, but there's got to be something funny. What's the weirdest thing you scan while you're on your hikes?
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of fences, cows.
No Sasquatch. The
No
Sasquatch
Sasquatch.
didn't make his way down. No.
No, nothing too crazy. I mean, shooting pit, a lot of RVs, a lot of cars, So I used to get really hung up on that, like, we don't want any cars in our scan. And this is like being this far ahead, and then you can't see right in front of you. It's like, just clip them out of the scan.
Yeah. It's a true digital twin, so it's part of the scene. So we've got a couple minutes. I want to maybe get your view, because again, doing my research about you, Ironwood, and stuff, I get the sense that you're looking at technology maybe in a different way. You're not afraid of the unknowns, and if anything, it's like try to do the work and then learn from that and then iterate. So you mentioned a couple of things, you know, like drones, swarm drones, the Boston Dynamic dog, you know, all sorts of stuff. But if I was to pull your thinking 10 years out from where we are today, what do you think? What technologies are you thinking about that, gee whiz, if we just made invented this thing, or maybe do we have the pieces already and it's more about integrating them together so that they work harmoniously? But if I pulled your thinking out 10 years, Eli, what is a world of that digital forester or that digital twin or that VR, AR reality or whatever AI slash I don't know what, but what do you think about when you kind of dream out 10 years out?
Back to swarm drones. I think they're going to get smaller and easier and more automated. And I don't know about 10 years, but eventually, forestry technician shows up on site, releases the drones, they come out, they come back, and then you have all your data. And I feel confident. I mean, I don't want to be the guy that says like, oh, nobody will ever use the internet, right? But I feel pretty confident that it's going to be either predominantly camera based or camera LiDAR combo. Because your machine learning, I think, is going to have a lot of benefits from that, the hyper realistic coloring. And right now, where my focus is shifting is to the neural radiance fields and the Gaussian splatting and the hyper realistic, right? So imagine that you can see the post-harvest outcome of your forest. And it just looks real, like we're there already, like we're already doing that. Ironwood's doing that,
So hold on. You said Nerf, Gaussian splatting. I know there's foresters on the call going like, did we just shift gears and we're like shooting little Nerf guns or what? But back us up and maybe introduce us to what these things are and why they're relevant to the average Joe and computer visualization.
Yeah, so I really don't know the technicals about it. Has to do with, I don't even know enough to explain it to you, but it's like photogrammetry, right? It's like your colorized point cloud and your photogrammetry, except whatever they did, this is about 18 months ago that this came out. It is just photorealistic. It is, and if your pictures are good enough and you're looking at it from the right scale, it's indistinguishable from a photograph, and it's a 3D model. And it's too new to process and segment like your LiDAR, but that's quickly changing, right? So I can follow up and provide examples for you and your viewers of what we've already done. But you delete the splats, as they're called, of whatever trees you're going to cut, and then you're left with the photorealistic, like, I mean, it's scary real, Kevin. Like, having nightmares that, because there's still like artifacts and errors that you can see. It's not perfect, and I'm waiting one day. I'm going to be walking down the street, and I'm going to see that life has been a simulation this whole time. I'm going to see that flicker in the matrix.
You're going to have a pill in each hand, right? And then you're going to be able to choose whether you're going the red one or the blue one, right? So, yeah, depending how the day's going, I suppose. Yeah, it's very cool.
So, I mean, that opens up a lot of options. I mean, that's what we're going to be focusing on next year, I think, because then you put it in the Unreal Engine. We want to build training programs for people. Like, what is it like to train in Arizona? You come out to Arizona and it's like deja vu. I feel like I've already been here. Put it in VR, put it in AR, put it on your desktop, put it on your Android, whatever you want. And, kind of more broadly speaking to your question about the future in 10 years, like I see kind of a split with AI and all this amazing technology. You've got AI creating things that are fake that look real, like creating a fake world, and then people that are getting better at capturing the real world. And it's like it feels similar, but it's really, really, different.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. Yeah, I always joke, well, not joke, but when you see some of these AI deep fakes, right, where you could be talking to yourself and it learned about you because of all the social media you've done, it's kind of crazy what the art of the possible could be. So let me pull your thinking 25 years out. What does the world look like at that point?
It's hard to tell. I really don't know. I think society will be significantly different. I think already a lot of the challenges facing forestry are less technological and more social. You know, we already have, I mean, as an employer, you know, I can lament, you know, you just can't hire people anymore. You can't get anybody that wants to work. Like the attitudes and the dispositions are different. It's harder to find people that want to go out and be outdoors all day, like grinding through the hard way. You know, a lot of them expect more to be in the office, you know, using tools, even if they're not maybe, you know, super knowledgeable about them yet. You know, so probably just more towards that. You know, I think, and I think we need to embrace that, and I think we need to account for that. We need a new type of forester, you know, and I think we need to be very deliberate about it, because the worst thing that we could do is put both feet forward on the digital technology side. You know, any success that I have, I attribute to being able to walk both worlds. You know, as a dirt forester, I was a production field forester. I could do what nobody else could do, what other people said couldn't be done, because I had that experience, just massive amounts of production in the forest. Like, if you can't find a way to do it, to automate it on the computer, we're just going to grind through it some hard way. And we're doing a lot of that, but it's working, you know. So how do we keep our young foresters to have that field competency, not only for the production, but also just for the insights?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Well, there's times I've joked with some people who have played with these ideas, and I'm like, technology may evolve to the point it's on our smartphones, we can do all this stuff, right? The mobile map, or it's like just put a Pokemon somewhere in some scene in nature and make a kid go out there and scan because they're chasing Pokemon Go, and there you go, you've done your 3,000 acres in a few snap of your fingers. But say that in jest, but then some folks say, well, maybe there's something with volunteer geographic information. Sometimes all themes come back in a full circle through time, but we'll see. So I know at the start you mentioned, you know, you went through the school and then, you know, undergrad, you're kind of taking maybe different courses. You know, by the way, I call that the gifted program nowadays, you know, a bit of arts, a bit of phys ed and all this stuff. But if you think back to your younger self, knowing what you know today, is there some pro tip advice that you would give young Eli going through that? Or would you say, you know what, just keep charging forward on that path? I am where I am now because of those experiences. But is there something you would give to young up and coming Eli Jensen Forrester, based on your experiences to date, some pro tips or pearls of wisdom?
My pro tip, man, there's so many, right? But probably towards the line of what you were saying is, like, don't tr like trust the process. Don't feel bad about all those different things that I explored, you know, because I had a lot of guilt in my youth. Like, why am I not focused just on forestry like all of my peers? You know, why am I doing a knife making business, you know, instead of, you know, like, did I start my career 5 years behind, 3 years behind, because I went out and I did these other things? You know, I'm like probably 9 credit hours away from having an art degree, you know, and I've done ceramics longer than I've done forestry, you know, because I took ceramics before I took my first field forestry class. But, you know, and I do tell young people this, like, if you only take forestry classes, you're going to be like an awful forester. Because all the solutions, like, people are looking at solutions in forestry, you know, very, very closely. And you need to bring insights from other places. You know, I probably never would have built that paint sprayer if I didn't have the skills I had and the confidence for making the knives. And it all snowballs from there. And, you know, you have the confidence to tackle new things and insights from other things. Like, I've made rain washable tree marking paint from my insights from ceramics, you know, with other esoteric things like defloculation. You know, like, what's defloculation, you know? So things like that. And to just explore and not be, You know, we put these scotomas in our minds, these mental blocks, you know, and it doesn't matter if it's ceramics or if it's the virtual reality or augmented reality. You know, I had one for virtual reality because I'd never done it, you know, and then I bought the headset and I put the Gaussian splat in Unreal, and it like it took longer to download, you know, Unreal Engine than to put it in there. Now I'm looking at my trees in virtual reality. You know, it really wasn't that hard. And I think young people, that's a life lesson that some people learn, you know, if you just go give it a shot, just go put your work boots on, just go show up, just go try it. A lot of those things are not that scary. And I think especially forestry culture and technology, like there's this huge mental block, you know, like LIDAR is so intimidating to the uninitiated. It was to me, right? Just go get cloud compare, you know, just go download a data set, you know, tinker with it. And it's going to be overwhelming and frustrating, but like you climb that learning curve and it's not so bad.
100%.
That's my advice to my younger self and to young people today is like, just go try different things. Cause I went to grad school specifically to avoid having to work in timber sale prep because I thought it was beneath me. And now it's what I do. I was kind of forced in that. I was kind of forced into it because there were no other jobs, but I'm glad it happened that way.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. So the last question I have for you is, we started off the podcast, you're saying you were some $30 profitable and you had to borrow $5 from your better half. Did you ever end up paying her back the fiber? And does she still think you're crazy because she's still with you doing this stuff? But obviously you're working together, you're realizing success now. $5 then is what, maybe with interest, what, 5,000, 500,000 maybe over now, right, for the support?
I tell the Forest Service, and I tell them without jest, that they should buy my wife flowers because she's funded more innovation development for public land management than anybody else. She's been so supportive. Things are turning around, but I mean, to do something like this, I mean, don't expect to earn a penny for 5-6 years. You know, that's pretty typical with starting a business. It's certainly not any better when you're doing business with the federal government, innovation with the federal government, innovation in forestry. You got to make sacrifices. And my wife is a wonderful woman that has made a lot of sacrifices for us. And we both made a lot of sacrifices, but it's like building towards something, you know, it's a high cost, but the price is worth what we're buying.
For sure. You're investing, you're learning and your growth, and that we know will pay dividends, multiple hand over fist through time. Hey, so we've looked a look down. I really enjoyed speaking with you. For those who are listening and want to follow up and get more information, maybe that offer for data, you know, the open data or whatnot, or to learn about NERFs and Gaussian splatting, to chat about that, what's the best way for folks to follow up with you at Ironwood Forestry?
Email EliJensen@ironwoodforestry.com.
Eli.Jensen or no dot, just Eli Jensen. Eli Jensen, no dot at ironwoodforestry.com. Eli, it's great to meet you, to have this conversation. I really enjoyed learning about your journey. I also enjoyed learning about, you know, the use of LIDAR at 3,000 acres, building a true digital twin, walking through that. Amazing. Sounds like you're almost done that project. Looking forward to seeing the final output and maybe doing a couple fly-throughs with you to discover forestry in your neck of the world. But thanks so much for carving out some time for this guy to speak with me, and looking forward to maybe meeting you in person one of these days.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me.